Hi folks, welcome to episode 92 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about Scott of the Antarctic, which is a story I don't know very well, I have to say. So you're going to have to explain to me what happened to poor old Scott. The only thing I know is that he died somewhere on like an Arctic shelf, ice floe or something.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do know it very well. It's one of my, right. It's among my favourite stories.
Okay.
Because it's sort of pre-World War One.
Yeah.
Sort of, so the very late age of sort of the heroes of empire. Mm. They called it the great heroic age of Antarctic exploration before things were motorized or anything.
Right.
Before you could fly down there or anything like that.
So right. Okay. So they had to sail all the way there.
Yeah. They go down on wooden ships.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. From New Zealand or Australia.
Yeah.
So, pardon me. So, yeah, let's get into it. First of all, just to say that, in the very beginning of the 20th century, still no one had ever been to the North or South Pole.
Really?
That's surprising, don't you think?
Mm.
I always find that surprising.
Well, there's a part of me that always thinks, well, what the hell's there other than snow?
Yeah, there's nothing there. It's like going to the top of Everest was only achieved in what, like the early 50s, 1950s?
Yeah. I remember seeing a poll of like the British public and something like more than half of them are like, no, I wouldn't go to Mars because there's nothing there.
Right.
Like, fair.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it.
All right. I feel the exact opposite. Now, you go there because it's there to be gone to. Like, why go to the top of Everest? Well, why not? Why do anything then? Really, I mean, it's a bit... But yeah, it's there. It's something to be conquered, isn't it?
Mm.
Like, why sail out into an ocean that you think is endless?
I mean, I guess...
Well, you might find America.
The most obvious answer is you won't die if you don't do it.
Right, yeah.
Because a lot of people die on these things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the mindset of a...
a person who doesn't want to die.
A complete pussy, yeah. So I think these men are very, very brave. These are extraordinarily brave men.
I think it's the mindset of someone who's responsible to his family.
Oh, right, actually, no, fair enough. Yeah, no, fair enough. If you've got a family, it's different. Of course. Yeah, no, I think...
Sorry, kids, I'm going to climb Everest now. I might not come back. Good luck. Anyway, go on.
No, it's people where... Doing the unknown for its own sake.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm glad because, it was them and not me.
Right, yeah. Because no one had ever hiked straight into the middle of Antarctica before.
Probably like, with what, good reason, though,
yeah, because
right?
It's a crazy thing to do. It really is. The first people to ever know for sure that there's an Antarctic landmass down there, it was the Russians in 1820. They were the first ship ever to go down there.
Mm.
Well, according to the formal story of history. Some say there may have been...
Well, I don't have any stock in the Piri Reis map.
Yeah, the Piri Reis map, right.
Because everyone's like, oh, look, it shows the landmass of Antarctica. It's like, no, it's a perfect correlation for South America.
It just bends round.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's at the bottom of the map, quite possibly. Yeah.
Right. It's just some 15th century Turk drew it wrong, okay? They didn't go to Antarctica.
Right.
They would have mentioned it, you know? Just nothing but endless ice. That would have come up. Anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, then why not? Why hasn't it been described anywhere before then? Anyway,
I mean, I've spent a lot of time in like my 20s and 30s looking into the historical conspiracy theories because they're exciting, right?
Mm,
Was the pyramids built by aliens? All this, none of it's true. None of it's true whatsoever. Absolutely none of it. Like every single historical conspiracy theory is just nonsense. It's just nonsense. I want them to be true, but they're just not. I feel like I'm Joe Rogan with Bigfoot. I want it to be true, but it's just not true.
You're right. There's one or two. I mean, I don't put a great deal of store in a lot of things someone like Graham Hancock says. But some of them, there are questions. There are mysteries.
Yeah.
You know, like, how is some precision engineering been done in the deep past? I don't know. But
and the answer is always autism. I'm not even joking. Like, people were just really diligent. Like, they just worked really hard.
Have you heard of the Antikythera mechanism?
Yep.
So that,
I've seen
example.
It.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. You think that wasn't the work of some ancient Greek artist?
Well, it exists, just, so it must have been.
Yeah, exactly. But people are like, what if it's alien technology?
Well, I don't think
it's clockwork.
Alien. Yeah.
You know,
it's not just, alien.
It's just some autistic Greek guy who was like, oh, look at this, you know, and just, you know, just spent 30 years in it, you know, in his bloody study, just, look, I've got this amazing thing. It moves around. It's like brilliant. Okay, we're going to go and invade Rome or whatever now. You know, it's like, it's just, autism has always existed. That's my answer to all of this.
Fair enough, yeah. This is completely out of place. Where are any of the machine tools that made it? Or you don't just go from nothing to 19-tiered cogs.
Yeah.
How does that... Anyway.
I'm not saying they didn't have a level of expertise that we don't attribute to them. You know, that there's quite a few examples, actually, like Hyros steam engine and stuff like that, where it's actually they were quite clever and they were on the verge of an industrial revolution. So there's no denying, and the Greeks of all people as well, like if you were going to develop a scientific method in the ancient world, they're going to be the people closest to it. It's not beyond the realms of sensible historical discourse, but it's not a conspiracy theory. There's not ancient alien artifacts. It's just all nonsense. I wish it wasn't, but it's all nonsense. Anyway.
Well, I don't put any stir in the ancient alien thing, or even really probably Graham Hancock's sort of pre-Ice Age lost civilization. But how did the Egyptians cut rose granite to extreme precision with apparently dolomite pounding stones or copper-tipped tools? It's like, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't add up. I'm not saying it's ancient aliens or anything like that, but...
I'm saying it's ancient autism.
It doesn't make...
There are loads...
You can't fashion granite with copper no matter how autistic you are. You just cannot do it.
No. The way that you do it is with sand, apparently. I've seen a few documents.
Okay, just lots and lots of time and energy.
Yes. Right. You basically grind these things down. So you split the rock with a hammer.
Right, I guess so.
And then you sand it.
I guess so. Yeah, just given enough time.
Yeah, given enough slave labor.
I suppose so. Or like extremely thin bowls that are made from extremely hard rock. It's almost transparently thin, or I don't know. Yeah, anyway. Anyway, we could go on and on about this.
Autism.
We should do one about this.
Yeah, we should, actually. I'd love to do like out of place artifacts or something at some point. Because there are loads of them where I can't explain them. But like, you know, there's no real evidence for like, you know, the ancient lost high-tech civilization.
I did an article on this a while ago where there's like...
interesting.
The schist disc, for example. Yeah. Like, what on earth is that?
Yeah.
What on earth is it? Let alone how was it made?
Yeah, I'd never even heard of
it. What is it?
We'll do that another time.
Back to Scott and the Antarctic and the Pre-Reese map. So when men first went around the world, or when Europeans that documented themselves doing it first went around the world, Magellan goes down to South America, the bottom of South America. Didn't realise you could sail all the way around the bottom of South America in the Tierra del Fuego. Thought you had to sort of cut through. So even to this day, there's the Straits of Magellan in that broken, fractured landmass at the bottom of South America. But even then, they thought that South America joined up to a giant southern landmass of some type. They weren't
sure.
Which
it probably did in some points.
Maybe in deep, deep past. Yeah. But when Drake went down there, not too long after Magellan, he realised, oh, no, you can just sail all the way around Tierra del Fuego. It's like the seas are giant and some of the worst seas in the world.
Yeah.
But you can do that.
Right.
However, he also realised for all sorts of reasons that with a sailor's eye, because he is a great navigator, one of the greatest navigators of all time, he realised, oh, there must still be some giant landmass down there, just the way the flows go and the way the winds go, there must be.
Right.
And then when other people went around the world, when Captain Cook in the 18th century, again, went around the world, didn't go down to Antarctica, but again, he was like, oh, no, yeah, there's certainly, you can deduce that there will be a giant landmass down there.
Right.
But not until the 1820s when the Russians went down there and landed on it. And they're like, yeah, okay, there's some sort of giant extra landmass, continental-sized landmass down here.
And it looks a lot like Russia.
yeah, it's very similar, yeah. In fact, they do use Siberian ponies at one point to do this, so yeah. But it's very, very, very difficult to even hit the Antarctic because it's surrounded by pack ice, even in the summer months.
Right.
In the winter, there's no chance. Right. In the summer months, obviously, which is our winter months because it's the southern hemisphere. So in January and December, the south's summer, you can try and hit the landmass. Right. And a few people did. The Russians did. The Japanese did at one point. A couple of different countries. I think the Norwegians sent something down there. But they realised, you know, pretty much straight away that, yeah, there's whole mountain ranges here. Mm. Like, for example, there will be, there's a giant volcano there, Mount Erebus. A volcano in in Antarctica.
Is it
surprisingly
active?
It was, yeah, yeah.
Right, okay.
I think it might be semi-dormant now, but yeah.
Right, okay.
There's a few volcanoes actually in Antarctica.
Hmm.
And so by the, let's cut ahead to the early 20th century, men thought, well, we need to go to the Arctic and Antarctic for the glory of it, if nothing right. else. You know, sort of, they're all Victorian people, the Edwardian age.
Hmm.
It was a thing to do, to explore. Hmm. The world as much as possible, to map and explore the world.
Go to the deepest, darkest regions of the Amazon and the Congo You know, weird, you know, Indonesia or whatever. And then obviously the other extreme, which is go and walk across 10,000 miles of ice.
Mm.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Hope you come back with all your toes.
For the glory of saying you've done it. Yeah, trying to find the mouth of the Nile.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to find a northwest passage through northern Canada. All these sorts of things. So, both America, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, France, these are the countries that try that were in a position to try these things. The North Pole, in 1909, I think it was, an American got that one.
Really?
Robert Peary. Yeah, he sort of Amundsen, the great Amundsen, who'll come into this, the Norwegian, who was very, very experienced in Greenland. Was going to do the North Pole.
Right.
And he was pipped by Robert Peary, just pipped him. They thought they could, because the North Pole, there's no landmass there.
It's just frozen sea. It's just
frozen sea or pack ice.
Yeah.
And so they thought if they could get on the pack ice that was flowing in the right direction, you could get quite close and just allow it to drag you across the geographical North Pole and you could claim it that way. But an American who took a big team of Inuits, dog teams and Inuits, the best sledge dog teams in the world, just pipped him. So the Americans had got that one. However, the South Pole, for loads of different reasons, is just technically much, much harder than that. Much, much, much harder. That's sort of a piece of cake.
Really?
In a way, in comparison.
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because for a start, you can almost walk there from Canada.
Well, it's just going to be flat, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you don't have to have a massive, massive expedition to even get there. Then you don't have to walk across uncharted mountain ranges.
Yeah.
You don't have to walk across glaciers.
Yeah.
Crevasse-filled glaciers.
If it's just frozen pack ice, then it can't have too much in the way of geography.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So it's just this endless white, flat step,
it's like,
basically.
Yeah, yeah. Just the logistics of it are much, much, much easier. You don't have to put out tons and tons worth of depots and staging points to get to do all of it. It's just way easier.
Antarctica is actually a continent with land underneath and, as you say, mountains and volcanoes.
It's like a transantarctic mountain range, and in the middle of Antarctica there's like a higher plateau. You have to go up glaciers, go up mountains, and then you sort of summit, but then it's a giant, like, incredibly desolate plateau. And you're at like 9,000 feet 10,000 feet. And it's like being at the top of a mountain. There's not much oxygen. You're sort of dying. The human body's kind of dying the whole time. You're up
there. And it's going to be like minus 30.
Yeah.
The time.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds awful.
50, 60, 70 miles an hour wind, minus 40, up to minus 70. Just crazy, yeah.
Yeah, why would you do it?
Well, it's like going to the moon.
Yeah.
You can bring back a few moon rocks and do a few sort of experiments on gravity. But yeah. There's not actually a great point in doing it, but you've set new limits. You've raised the bar for humanity.
No, that's fair.
I'm of the school of thought that it's great stuff.
It is. It absolutely is great stuff.
Braver.
Not
braver,
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Braver than I would ever be, I think.
Oh, yeah.
If someone said you could go to Mars, and there's a decent chance, there's like 20, 30, 40% chance you're going to die. Would you do it? Oh, no, you've got a family, of course. What if you didn't have a family?
Still wouldn't do it.
Yeah, because I think I would. I think I would. Just to perhaps...
Best of luck.
Perhaps make it into the history books. I don't know.
I'd have too active an imagination, to be honest.
Like, tired of reading about other people's great achievements.
Sure, but I can just imagine too many things that would go wrong. I'd be like, it's just not worth it.
It'd be terrifying the whole time, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well,
until you got back to Earth.
Yeah.
It would probably be quite terrifying.
Yeah, not for me. But I'm glad that some people are doing it.
Fair enough. So the Admiralty, the British Admiralty, really wanted this South Pole thing because it's a point of national prestige as well. It's like going to the moon. Yeah. That will always be America's achievement, going to the moon first, if you believe they really did it. So the
Stanley Kubrick will always be responsible for America. No, I'm joking.
Yeah. Stanley Kubrick's film.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 1901, they send their first attempt down there, the ship, the Discovery, and Captain Scott is the captain of it. One of his right-hand men, one of the most important guys on that ship, is Ernest Shackleton, who will come into it later. And just to cut short, the Discovery, they do hit the Antarctic landmass. They make a big hut there, the Discovery hut, at Hut Point. But they don't get, and they try hiking, they try making depots, supply depots towards the pole, but don't really get all that far.
Right.
They get maybe a third of the way. It's like, what, 900 odd miles.
A third of the way still seems like a lot.
Yeah, still had a good crack at it. But again, these really were, that Discovery expedition of 1901 really were the first humans ever just to hike straight southwards.
Yeah.
They didn't know there was going to be this giant plateau or mountain range or anything. They didn't know.
Yeah, they had no idea.
Yeah. So they
didn't know they were all going to get eaten by Yetis. You know? They didn't know.
Yeah. And they're not expert skiers. It's all on foot, man hauling giant sleds, just literally pulling the giant sleds along themselves.
Well, I take it they had to bring all of their own food. I mean, like,
hunt everything. Absolutely everything. Yeah.
It's a lot of weight to take.
Yeah. You take loads of timber as well to build a big hut once you get there.
Yeah. But even then, how warm could that have been?
Well, you're out of the wind. I mean, quite often Scott talks about how minus 13 is nice, minus 17 is balmy.
Thank God.
It's absolutely fine.
Thank God it's minus 13.
But at minus 20 or 30, you're a bit uncomfortable. Yeah, hardier.
Just a bit.
Hardier men than they make these days.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, they make a point of not really complaining, hardly ever. Yeah. It's got to be absolutely dire straits before anyone will really complain about anything. Like you're sort of dying of frostbite before you mention it.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
Very stoic.
Sterner stuff.
In 1901, they go down there and there's another important figure who's Dr. Wilson, who comes into it a fair few times. He's on all sorts of these different expeditions. And Scott, Wilson and Shackleton make an attempt to push as far south as they possibly can. And Shackleton actually gets a little bit weak or lame or something wrong with his leg, and the other two have to haul him back. But they never got close, really.
Yeah.
But later, Scott wrote about how Shackleton had let them down. That's like a bit of a slap in the face. That is really out of order in the Edwardian period to call someone out like that.
So, well, yeah, but I mean, like, sorry, you know.
It's true, yeah.
Didn't mean to become lame.
Right, yeah. Can't help it.
Yeah.
Like, later, we'll get into how some people start blistering up and sunburning and going snowblind and getting frostbite, and others won't. They've had the same amount of warmth and energy and everything, and some guys' health just fails before others. And it's not your fault, really, is it?
No. I mean, what can you do?
It's like being at high altitude. Some people's bloodlets can hold oxygen better than others. Mm. You might even be overweight or something, but you can deal with altitude better than someone. And that's just... It's not your fault one way or another, is it? You're just sort of born with that ability.
It's how you're made.
Yeah, right. So after the Discovery, a few years passed, and then the Admiralty give Shackleton his own shot, his own...
Sorry, before we go on. They travelled 900 miles inland. What sort of technology did they have?
Just to say, from the coast to the pole is about 900 odd miles.
Oh, right. So they travelled 300.
Two or 300 miles, yeah.
Still 300 miles.
Yeah,
minus 20.
Crazy, right?
What sort of technology do they have? So this is going to be sort of, early 20th century. So, I mean, it's just going to be a compass, right?
And sextant and compass. Yeah.
And, presumably they had lots of, was it woolen coats or something? I mean, like, what were they wearing?
I'll put pictures up so people can see. Not enough, it looks like. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking modern, like I've got a really, really nice coat for winter and it's modern fibres and all that. And it keeps me very, very warm. And I'm thinking they didn't have that, you know?
Yeah. It's crazy what they're wearing. Like I'll show pictures from the Scott expedition. Yeah. And it's like they're wearing a jumper, a woolen jumper and like a thin smock.
See, I felt silly saying
and a woolly hat.
I felt silly saying they'd be wearing wool, but okay, they were actually wearing wool.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's not enough. Like there's a great picture of Amundsen and actually another one of Robert Peary.
Yeah.
And they're all dressed up in Inuit gear with like reindeer fur.
Right, right.
And stuff. You're like, oh, well, that looks right.
Yeah, that looks like it could do the job.
But the Brits are just wearing not enough warm things. Mad it really does look like, yeah. one of the party who come into it, Bowers, it seems like he's almost impervious to cold. Even when Scott and the others are complaining that they've got to pull their balaclavas over their ears because they're gonna, or their noses are starting to get frostbitten, Bowers is just still walking around with just a woolly hat on and doesn't ever get frostbite or anything.
That's crazy.
And yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, what they're wearing is just, in fact, because Scott in his journals boasts quite a lot that they've got the best, most scientific gear possible.
What, a woolly hat?
Yeah. I mean, and he thinks that their gear is better than the Inuit reindeer furs.
No, it's not.
We know for a fact it's nowhere near as good.
Yeah, I don't need to know for a fact. I can look at it and see this.
Like reindeer fur stuff.
Yeah.
To this day is superb.
Yeah.
It's kind of obviously maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously these creatures evolved in these environments. And so of course they're well adapted to living in them. An Englishman's woolly hat is not well adapted to going to the Antarctic.
Yeah.
It's delusional fool.
It's not sort of explicitly done that it's about bravado, but that's definitely there.
Yeah.
That it's a little bit of who can, like, showing tough off to out. Each other a little bit. Yeah.
It's just stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. You would think at least wear more layers. Yeah. Why are you padded out like you're wearing exactly. 8 layers?
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. You know, obviously, a woolly jumper is going to be one of the layers or 2 or 3 of the layers. Then you want some sort of windproof smock or something over it. So you've got protection from the chill.
They do wear these smock things, but they're not very thick.
Right.
They're not sort of padded and insulated, it doesn't look like.
But I mean, I guess they wouldn't have to be if you were wearing like 6 layers of wool, but they're not, are they?
Yeah.
So it's just like.
It's crazy. Yeah, really.
Mental.
Very, very hardy individuals. They manhaul, we need to talk about their technology, they manhaul things, dragging their own sleds just by foot. And a bit on skis sometimes.
Don't they have dogs?
It's part of the way, you have some dog teams.
Oh, what happens to the dogs?
And some, different things on different expeditions.
Oh, right.
And sometimes ponies.
Right.
Which is really the wrong thing to do. A hoofed foot on snow is bad.
And also, don't they eat a lot?
Well, yeah, you need loads of fodder for them.
They can't just graze.
Yeah. Because a hoofed foot is like standing on a single finger almost.
Yeah.
So it's going to punch through any sort of snow or ice.
Mm.
If it's a hard surface, the ponies had a good going.
Mm.
But if it's soft or soft snow, well, they just sink down and then you've got to wade through that.
Yeah.
Taking horses or ponies to the Antarctic is not a good idea. And yet they did it loads. And I'll mention in Scott's last expedition, the main one of the Terra Nova, they take motorized skidoos.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll put up a picture so everyone can see. They're like, it's only like 1910 still.
Yeah.
They've got like these big motorized sledges.
Yeah.
We'll talk all about that. But it's very early still. I mean, 1910, like commercial cars would be quite rare.
Yeah. How reliable these things could have been. Surely the question.
Okay, so after the Discovery expedition, Shackleton gets his own shot in sort of 1908. They go down there in 1909. He's aboard the Nimrod.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually gets quite close. There's the Ross Ice Shelf down there. There's the Ross Sea. Loads of things were named after Captain James Ross from the Victorian period. There's like the Ross Sea, Ross Island, the Ross Ice Shelf. And you land on the side of the Ross Ice Shelf in the shadow of Mount Erebus. And you go towards hike inwards, south, and you find, you will nearly always find this one particular giant glacier that goes up, cuts through the mountain range, the Beardmore Glacier, very famous glacier. People just call it the Beardmore. Giant glaciers like that are very, very, very dangerous places, ridiculously dangerous, really. A crevasse field, a moving crevasse field.
Precarious.
It's sort of, I've heard more modern people, like Ranulph Fiennes, say, yeah, it's trying to kill you. It's trying to eat you at every step. Unless you're very, very good, very, very careful, you will come a cropper on something like the Beardmore.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you get to the top of that, then you've still got more mountain range. And then eventually you hit that higher plateau. And all in all, about 900 odd miles. Shackleton in the Nimrod, they get to within his final party, gets within about 90 nautical miles of the pole. So that's quite close. It's very close, really. That's probably a week, or between a week and 2 weeks worth of marching to have got there.
What made them turn back?
Well, they just didn't have enough, all sorts of reasons. Right. They were, as army people say, was on their chin strap. They were nearly dying already. Right. They're very low on all sorts of provisions and fuel, and the weather was worse than they thought. It'd taken them longer than they thought to do different stages. They got very close, but it would have been suicide to push on. And so Shackleton turns back. But however, that is the world record. No one had ever been anywhere near that close before. And then the following year, or that year actually, is when Robert Peary gets to the North Pole. And so when Shackleton and the Nimrod come back, it's like, the South Pole is still this last shining great prize of the heroic age of exploration. And the Admiralty really wants it. So do the Norwegians. So in 1910, they give Captain Scott his second shot, his second attempt to do it in the Terra Nova. They send down a couple of ships. You leave from New Zealand. So this is the big one. This is where they think they're going to definitely be able to do it, and it's all very highly publicized in the press back home,
right?
And everyone, like the whole nation's behind it, hoping that the great captain Robert Falcon Scott can win this prize. The Americans may have pipped us all to the North Pole, but we'll definitely get the South Pole, and that's harder and a better prize anyway, and all that sort of thing. And in the papers, everyone's wishing him the best and things. So they go down there, and there's a ship of, there's like, I don't know, what is there, like 60 or 70 guys aboard the ship. And they try and land at Hut Point, where the Discovery had landed in 1901, 1902. And they can't quite get it because of pack ice, the floes. Right. And Scott's really a bit upset by that. One of a few times, apart from towards the end, where he says, I'm terribly disappointed about something. Because usually they're like, it's no problem. The psychology you need is to never complain, always be optimistic. Whatever adversities are thrown your way, just deal with them with a cheery smile on your face.
Yeah,
that's the attitude you need. You have to have, really.
Yeah.
But he was a bit disappointed he couldn't get to that hut. Anyway, they set up a new base, and it's not until the following year that they actually head out. It's like it's the our winter of 1911 to 1912, the Antarctic summer, that they actually do the final push. So for a whole year before that, they're setting up their camp. They're making these depots. There's like 69, 70 camps between base camp and the South Pole, but there's like 11 depots between them, like all the way to the bottom of the Beardmore, at the top of the Beardmore, and then across the plateau, these supply depots, so that when you do your final push, it's possible to do.
You've got things there. It just wouldn't
be possible to manhaul all your stuff in one push back. They call it like in climbing, it's like the Alpine style of climbing, which is in the morning, you start at the bottom of the mountain, and you climb all the way to the top and down again in one day.
Yeah.
That's the Alpine style. Well, some mountains are just too big to do that. You can't climb Everest Alpine style.
Yeah.
You have to have base camps, various base camps at various points. So anyway, the Antarctic is like that. You can't do it in one go. You just can't. So 900 odd miles, at least 11 depots. And they've got all sorts of names like One Ton Depot is a famous one, 3 Degree Depot, Upper Glacier Depot, Mid Glacier Depot, Mid Barrier Depot.
Like, how many miles a day do they cover?
All right, well, that's the thing. Sometimes as few as 3 or 4 or 5.
Really?
And that's struggling for sort of 7-8 hours. But sometimes, you know, a good day, like 15 miles.
Right, okay.
Sometimes a little more. On the way back when you're going a lot downhill, sometimes a bit more. But it all depends on the weather, the condition of the men or ponies or horses, and how bad the going is, how bad the ground is. And we'll talk about that a fair bit later, but how well the sledges glide across the snow.
Right.
So when they glide well, it's great. And other times every step is a massive struggle.
Yeah.
Because different types of snow, like you don't want crystally powdery snow because it acts like sand. It's right. Like pulling it through sand. You want a hard, icy crust.
Right. Okay.
So it will just slide across, you know.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay. So just to mention on their way down there, it's the seas, the Antarctic oceans are... Well, the worst oceans in the world, obviously. quite obviously, yeah. They got like 15 ponies. Shackleton on the Nimrod had taken Siberian ponies, and he'd claimed that the white ones were the best ones. So Scott says, right, I only want white Siberian ponies. I'm going to take 15 ponies down.
Okay.
And loads of dogs, loads of dog teams, big dogs. They're not huskies, but these are like these big... sort of not St. Bernards either. I can't remember the breed, but they look like big St. Bernards, basically.
Right.
Again, I'll put pictures up. And the English are very, they treat them as, even though they're pack animals, they're work animals, treat them very much as sort of pets, really. Give them all names treat them very, very well. Amundsen treats his dogs quite badly. Well, not badly. They're just, again, they're just a beast of burden.
Yeah.
They're not pets. Whereas we treat them much more like pets and try and...
This is long of... foreigners commented on the English love of their own animals. It's really weird. Like, what do you guys not like your animals? Like, they're quite nice normally.
Yeah, some cultures think dogs are sort of filthy and you shouldn't be near them really ever. And we treat them as members of the family.
Yeah,
I love dogs. Yeah, absolutely love dogs. Humans don't deserve dogs. That's how great I think dogs are. I absolutely love dogs. If I had lots of land and money, I'd have a pack of dogs. They did take one actual pet, a collie, a female collie bitch.
Yeah.
They take down there. Lassie, they call her.
I bet she was thrilled to be there.
Well, yeah. They obviously didn't realise, but at some point she gives birth to a litter of puppies. They didn't realise she was pregnant.
Well, that's not good news.
Yeah, but she smothers them all.
Right.
Just sits on them one night when no one's really watching, smart kills them all. A bit of foreboding there, a bit of foreshadowing of the story to come.
Probably had some understanding that they're not going to survive.
Maybe that.
You know. Actually, it may have been the merciful thing to do.
Yeah, maybe. She might not have been able to make milk or God knows what, but that's what happened. Bit of a horrible little story there. On the ship, on the way down, they get caught in pack ice. Mm. Like, they know there's an actual landmass, but they get caught in the pack. It sort of freezes around them for ages, weeks at a time sometimes. And you can get out of the ship. It's going nowhere.
Yeah.
And get out of the ship and even go skiing on the ice, go and take pictures, because this is the grand age of photography when they take pictures on glass slides.
What's he going to do, stuck in pack ice?
Yeah. Go and play football.
I guess.
On the ice. There's pictures of them playing football next to the stranded Terra Nova.
Right.
And we now know that pack ice like that can easily crush and sink a ship, completely crush it, destroy it, because that happened to later expeditions. But they're lucky. They luckily get out of it. Mm. It is real luck,
It's just hundreds of tons of solid ice, isn't it? So I'm not surprised they can crush a ship.
Yeah. Well, millions of tons.
Well, yeah, millions. Yeah, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah. Absolutely unstoppable, monstrous forces will crush the hull of a wooden ship. No problem.
Yeah, no easy kidding. Peasy. Yeah.
But it never happened before. So they, in fact, there's one entry in Scott's journals where he says, I don't think the pack ice would ever crush the ship.
Optimistic.
And again, it's like, you're so wrong.
And you're so lucky.
Yeah, you got really lucky that it didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Eventually it releases them.
That's weird, because I'd be so much more cynical. But like, look, I think... these millions of tons of ice might have the capacity to break our little wooden ship. You know, I'd just be skeptical.
They thought that maybe it might sort of push the ship up and it'll like keel over, but then be, but no, it does. It will eventually trap the bottom of the hull.
Yeah.
And pancake it.
Splinter it.
Yeah. And there's lots and lots of descriptions about the pack ice. Mm. And they just call it the pack. Lots of descriptions of seals and orca whales, killer whales. Mm. He calls them gladiator orcas for some reason.
Right, okay.
But lots of descriptions of those. Lots and lots of descriptions of just the beauty of the landscape, of the sea, of the ice, of the icebergs.
Mm.
Just call them bergs. Mm. And the way the sunlight plays off of it, all the right. different colours you can see at different times, all the different sort of optical illusions that the sun plays on the horizon, loads of things. And because Scott and his men, that are largely, nearly all ex-Royal Navy men, hard-bitten soldiers, extremely hardy, hard-bitten men, and yet he can't prevent himself from sort of waxing lyricals about all the crimson and gold colours and the blues that you can see in icebergs and the purples. And
because my I've never been to Antarctica, obviously, and my vision of the sea is just this horrific grey, roiling, storm-swept, like, nightmare, you know? Like, it's just, you know, I picture everything as being dark and gloomy all the time. But obviously it's not that way, you know.
Yeah, no, when there's not a squall, when the weather hasn't come in, when you're not in a blizzard, it can be very calm.
Right.
And also the way it works when you're at ultra high or low altitudes is that in the winter it's dark all day.
Yeah.
The sun doesn't come up for months.
Yeah.
But in the summer it's light all night.
Mm.
The sun doesn't go down, so it's not dark in the summer anyway.
Yeah.
It's can be blindingly bright. In fact, you can get snow blindness. It can sort of burn your eyes.
Right, okay.
Because it's so glaringly bright.
Yeah.
Not warm. It's interesting, actually, he says, it's surprising how bright the sun can be and afford no warmth to you. It's crazy. It's sort of counterintuitive, really. But there you go.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.